It had resulted in the revelation that this wicked Haman is the vicious enemy of Esther's cousin and guardian Mordecai. And by extension, it was Haman that wanted to kill all the Jews, including Queen Esther herself. Ahasuerus was so distressed by this revelation that he stomped out into the palace courtyard or the garden there to catch his breath, collect his thoughts. When he returns after a moment, he found Haman having fallen upon the queen to beg for his life and perhaps intentionally misinterpreting what he saw as an attempted rape. He sentenced Haman to death. Very helpful servant standing there says, oh, he just built a gallows out in his backyard. Why don't you just hang him there? Conveniently ready and unused, and he intended it for Mordecai. And so the king had said, hang him on that very spike that he had erected at his home for Mordecai. Chapter 8 then began with an account of how Esther was, we saw this last time, she was personally enriched by the king. The king gave to the queen Haman's property. As far as we know, that had never happened before. But we don't know of any other time. It certainly wasn't typical for the king to make his queen independently wealthy. But he ceded to her all the property of Haman, and she had made Mordecai the overseer of the property. And then the king promoted Mordecai to grand vizier, gave him the signet with the king's seal that he'd taken from Haman when he had him hauled out to be executed, and gave that to Mordecai and made him the new grand vizier. And so with those two actions, that made Mordecai and Esther essentially safe from all of the turmoil that was going on. But, you know, imagine that you're standing on the deck of a battleship at war, and an enemy destroyer has just fired a salvo of torpedoes at your ship. And the commander of the battleship immediately orders missiles fired at the enemy ship, and that enemy ship is struck with the missiles and is blown to bits, and everybody on the battleship celebrates. Got to remember the torpedoes that are still in the water. Don't forget the torpedoes that are in the water. And that's where we are here with this situation. The king has elevated Esther and Mordecai, but Esther reminded him in chapter 8, verses 3 through 6, that didn't really solve the problem. And he hadn't, in fact, yet fulfilled his promise to give Esther whatever she asked. She asked not just for her life, but for the lives of her people. And he hadn't done anything about that yet. So kind of like the torpedoes in the water, that edict that had been signed by the king and sealed by Haman was still in effect. The king couldn't rescind it. He couldn't just he couldn't just tell them, no, I changed my mind, you can't kill the Jews after all. There's been an order decreed that they can kill the Jews and seize their property on the 13th day of the 12th month. So what he did is he authorized Mordecai to write a new edict that would in some way counteract the original edict without actually nullifying it. And so what Mordecai did is he quickly wrote a decree in the king's name that permitted the Jews throughout the empire to assemble for their own defense, to gather together as a militia and arm themselves to defend themselves and to slaughter all attackers and even to seize the property of those that they killed, those who came up to attack them, whose lives they took. It was sealed also with the king's signet. It was sent out 9 months in advance before the scheduled slaughter of the Jews. And it was posted with great haste throughout the empire. What it did is it just literally gave the Jews a fighting chance, okay, to survive the original decree. And possibly even not just survive, but to eliminate a high percentage of their enemies and potentially to be enriched in the process. Now, I can imagine that those 9 months were filled with frantic preparation. But that entire busy period of preparation for everybody's actions is skipped over in the narrative. Because after the close of chapter 8, when that edict was posted, to the opening of chapter 9, the 9 months pass, and we, by the time the chapter 9 opens, we're there. It's D-Day, as it were. It's time for the enactment of the edict. It's time for all of the action. Let's pray, and we'll get into the text that we'll be looking at this evening. Father, we ask that you would bless tonight as we study this portion of your word, as we see it not just as a fascinating and even exciting historical narrative, but also the truth behind it, that you are the guardian of your people and the guide of historical events, and that we might that our own confidence in you and in your direction might be strengthened and enhanced, that we might rejoice in all that we face as we know it's working according to your will and your direction. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, the very first verse provides an initial summation. It says, "Now in the 12th month, that is the month Adar, on the 13th day, when the king's command and edict were about to be executed, on the day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, it was turned to the contrary, so that the Jews themselves gained the mastery over those who hated them." So here's how I've summed it up in the outline. Letter A, the date to execute the edict had arrived. It was now the day. Now, we won't get to the very end of this chapter tonight. I'll cover that in the final message along with the very brief chapter 10. It reminds us at the end of the chapter that this particular date hadn't been selected entirely at random. It had been selected by Haman's casting of lots for the most auspicious day for his sake as to when this might occur. The narrative picks up then on that 13th day of the 12th month. So it's identified both by the calendar and by that anticipation. We've been seeing this day coming for chapters now. We've known it was on its way, and now here we are. It's the day, it says, that the Jews' enemies hoped to gain the mastery. Now, in this case, the word hoped doesn't mean the same thing as the New Testament use of the word hope that we were talking about this morning. Here it is more like, "I hope it snows so we get a day off from school," like I'd use that as an illustration. It's maybe getting a little late for that, but still there are some holdouts who are still maybe hoping. You know, the teachers are still hoping. Sherry's not expecting, "Honey, please, one snow day in March, that'd be all right, or two or three." You thought it was just the kids who wanted snow days, all right? No. Anyway, the Jews' enemies hoped, kind of expected, that they were going to gain the mastery over the Jews. They were going to finally destroy them, get rid of them. But as we've been anticipating now for a while, the counter edict that's been issued by Mordecai, it says it was turned to the contrary. The NIV says the tables were turned. It's a little bit of an interpretive thing, simply because there's nothing in here about tables. The Hebrew says it was turned over. The point is that instead, the Jews themselves gained dominion or gained the mastery over those who hated them. So the reverse is what actually happened. Most of you are aware that I'm a basketball fan. I like to watch basketball games. Sherry likes to tease me when I'm watching a game because I'll suddenly grab the remote and run it back because I want to see a shot again. And she'll say, "Why are you bothering? Because you know he shot the ball and went in the basket." You already know. Why do you have to see it again? I said, "Because I want to see the pass that got him the ball and the move he put on the guy to get the ball into the basket. I want to see it again." Right? I like a little more detail. And the truth is, the book could have ended after verse 1. Right? He summarized it. The Jews, the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them. It was turned to the contrary, so the Jews themselves gained the mastery over those who hated them. Period. We can go on back to Ezra, right? Well, I'm kind of glad we get a little more detail. It gives us we don't get near as much detail as I would have liked, but we do get a little more detail, so we can know a little more of what's happened there. You've heard me say that about a lot of different things, so I'll go on. The final preparation for the engagement in verses 2-4. He backs up a little bit and gives us a little bit of a preview, a little bit of a lead-in to the preparation. They assembled in their cities for defense. Verse 2, "The Jews assembled in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could stand before them, for the dread of them had fallen on all the peoples." They gathered in the cities. Now, one of the things to note is that this was not just one or a handful of local rallies where people got together for these events, as it were. These occurred throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, as the Edict of Mordecai had permitted them to do. The New American Standard, the English Standard, and the King James say they did this to lay hands on those who intended them harm. The NIV and the Holman Christian Standard say they did this to attack, which is a little more aggressive, implies a little more aggressive action or offensive action. The NET Bible says to strike out against. The Hebrew literally says to stretch out their hands against. So any one of those interpretations is possible. Any one of those ways of translating that would be possible. I think that the emphasis should be more on defensive action than offensive action. They gathered in the cities to do this. I'll develop that as we go here. The intent of the edict was primarily defensive. It wasn't that the Jews could go out and find their enemies. That's what the original edict, Haman, had said that those who hated the Jews could do. You could go out and find the Jews, kill them, take their property. Mordecai's edict primarily was focused on the Jews banding together to defend themselves and kill those who attacked. There's a little difference. They're not what we shouldn't. I don't think we should picture this as the Jews banding together as kind of roving, marauding gangs going around the land looking for the people that they didn't like to kill or that didn't like them. I think what we see is they gather together in the cities to organize into militias. That's what I got first. They organized into militias. Implies organizing into militias so that their enemies wouldn't be able to pick them off in isolation. So they gathered together. I think it's probably important that it says they gather together in their cities. In the Old Testament, there are different words used for large assemblages of dwelling places. Sometimes it's called a village. Sometimes it's a town. Sometimes it's a city. It's not the primary distinction between them isn't the number of dwelling places. It's the fortifications. Cities were generally those that were fortified, had a wall around them. Towns and villages generally did not have a wall around them for defense. I think it's probably significant that it says they gathered in the cities. The implication is that they used fortifications. That's number two. It implies the use of fortifications, which again, I think implies that this was defensive. They gathered together in defensible positions and even fortified locations so they could defend themselves. I think what we need to understand is that the Jews really were not the aggressors on this day, at least in general. And the next clause doesn't necessarily imply otherwise when it says that no one could stand before them. Doesn't necessarily imply that they were out there marauding. I think what that means is just that no one successfully opposed them. No one successfully opposed them. None of their attackers succeeded in bringing them down. Now, I suspect that the counter-edict discouraged a lot of people who might have otherwise attacked the Jews for plunder that decided to leave them alone. But remember who Haman was. You know, he as a descendant of Agag the Amalekite, we've been reminded that the Amalekites had not been completely destroyed and that the Amalekites did, in fact, bear a centuries-old hatred for the Jews. Haman's family were almost certainly not the only Amalekites in the empire. Also remember that the Persian Empire had absorbed the Babylonian Empire, which had absorbed the Assyrian Empire, which had absorbed all of the old historic enemies of the Jews. You've got the Canaanites, you've got the Hittites, you've got the Amorites, you've got the Edomites, you've got the Assyrians themselves. All of those groups are still there. All of those groups still hate the Jews. They are surrounded by enemies, as they have been. And don't forget the guys back in Jerusalem trying to rebuild the temple and trying to make a life there. They've got the Samaritans and all those enemies back there, too. We'll be going back to see what's going on back there in a little bit. Because Ezra, when we go back to Ezra, it picks up just 13 years later from the book of Esther. Okay. And all that's still going on back there. And they're still part of this empire. That Judea is one of the provinces of King Ahasuerus. And so none of those enemies were able to strike down the Jews the way they had kind of hoped they could. Now, I think the counter-edict probably dissuaded the opportunists who looked at it as an opportunity to get a bunch of money or something or some property. But those who truly hated the Jews still rose up against them, and thousands of them died, as we will see. But even those enemies could not stand before them. It says, because the dread of them. Now again, as I mentioned in the last chapter, that might be a veiled reference to God himself, as the dread of them, as he's sometimes called the fear of, particularly the fear of Isaac. That expression shows up more often than in relation with any of the other patriarchs. But the fear of God is always seen to be a good thing, a beneficial thing for people to learn something about him. And so it may be a veiled reference to him here, but it was certainly manifest as a terror of the Jews themselves. They were intimidated, they managed to intimidate even their most ardent enemies in this, and not least because the king's opinion had changed and had given them a permission to defend themselves. Well, a second aspect of all this preparation is seen in verse 3, the first part. Even all the princes of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and those who were doing the king's business assisted the Jews. Now, again, he's using various titles for those at different levels of government. Princes, he mentions first, which is kind of a general term for anybody in authority. The satraps are the highest ranking of the government officials below the king. Because the whole kingdom was divided into satrapies. Each satrap was divided into sections that were ruled over by individual governors. The governors divided their territories into sections that had their own rulers or princes. And so that would be kind of the hierarchy that we're looking at here. But there were a lot of lesser government officials as well that were involved in aiding the Jews, and that's all. They're all lumped together under that general description, those who were doing the king's business. Employees of the crown, the people appointed over all the empire, were giving assistance to, not the enemies of the Jews, but to the Jews. We're not told what form this took. It might have included, it probably did include, political rhetoric. They probably spoke out and encouraged people to leave the Jews alone, encouraged the Jews to band together, encouraged people to help the Jews in their defense against their enemies. That's probably part of it. It certainly included the provision of money to help pay for their defense, possibly to pay for weapons or even the direct supply of weapons and aid for them, or even troops. It doesn't say exactly what form all that aid took. I think we can probably understand it to encompass all of that in various places. It probably wasn't uniform in that some of them gave them more help than others, but all of them were banding together to aid under the instruction of the head of the government, the king, and particularly the grand vizier. So we see that they received government aid. But then the last statement in verse 3 and the beginning of verse 4, we see something about who's really responsible for this on a personal level, on a human level. Because it says the dread of Mordecai had fallen on them. Indeed, Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai became greater and greater. I think it's interesting that what it said earlier was that the dread of the Jews had fallen upon all the peoples, but the officials offered their aid primarily because the dread of Mordecai had fallen on them. Don't overlook that. We look at Esther because the book's named for Esther, don't overlook just how important a figure Mordecai is in all of this. In many ways, he's the more important of the two. On a human level. Well, it was the dread of Mordecai that encouraged the government officials to aid them. How swiftly political positions can shift when the prevailing wind changes directions. Not much has changed in politics, but we see now Mordecai is in charge, and that's having a great impact. Mordecai's reputation was great and growing. He'd served as an official at the gate of the king to the gate to the citadel at Susa. He was evidently, as I've said, don't forget this. He was evidently descended from Israel's first king, King Saul. When he's identified in terms that would make us believe that that's who he was, that he's a descendant of King Saul. But the text until now has said nothing to indicate that anybody outside the capital knew who Mordecai was. Now, the people in the capital knew him, But there's really not been any indication that Mordecai was known throughout the empire. But he's becoming known. Since he wrote that edict, posted it throughout all the empire, everybody's talking about the new sheriff in town, if you will. And what it says literally in the Hebrew, his reputation was walking throughout the provinces. Okay, and that he became greater and greater. His reputation was growing. Now, all this happened before the attacks. This is all background. This is all preparatory. I said it skipped over those 9 months without saying anything because all of a sudden we're there, but it does back up and give us a little bit to tell us how the mood had changed and how the preparations were made. Now, as we move into verses 5 to 16, on the 13th day of the 12th month, verse 5 picks up on that day with the complete devastation of their enemies. The complete devastation of their enemies. Verse 5 sounds pretty aggressive and pretty bloodthirsty. But if you're reading the book straight through in a single sitting without interruption, you'd be more likely to notice something. The wording intentionally incorporates some of the language of the king's initial instruction to Haman in chapter 3, verse 11, when he told them concerning the people to do with them as you please. And then Haman's initial edict was to destroy and to kill. So we read chapter 9, verse 5, "Thus the Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying, and they did what they pleased to those who hated them." Right? The point is, what Haman had said the enemies should do to Israel actually came back on them. And he uses the same wording in many cases, the same exact words, just slightly different phrasing, that the Jews destroyed and killed those who came up against them and did what they pleased to those who hated them. It's not to emphasize any kind of to say that they performed atrocities of some kind. The point is that what Haman had intended didn't work. It reversed itself upon them, which is exactly what the language in the previous verses had indicated. The central point is that the Jews won. First, we note that they destroyed all their enemies at the citadel in verse 6. At the citadel in Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. Now, he doesn't provide very many details, as I said. Throughout this narration, he's using what's probably round numbers. 500 sounds like a lot in the citadel. But bear in mind that powerful political enemies of the Jews that were the supporters of Haman, that were maybe the friends of Bigthan and Teresh, the guys who had been plotting a coup against the king, the assassination of the king that Mordecai had revealed. Who knows how many others may have hated Mordecai and the Jewish presence there in the capital and come up against them. Mordecai had evidently had support within the palace so that he had armed guards for him and for Esther. And so it just says the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men in the citadel there at Susa. Then we're told they also killed the 10 sons of Haman. By tradition, when the Jews read the book of Esther at the Feast of Purim, when they get to this section, from verse 7 through verse 10a, is supposed to be read in a single breath. The point being, the point being is to show contempt for the sons of Haman and to skim over them, by skimming over them quickly and to indicate that they all died at once. Now the pronunciations are a little unfamiliar, so I don't know if I'll manage, but I'm going to try to do that in a single breath, as they would say. I'll start with verse 6. At the citadel in Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men, and Parshandatha, Dalphon, Aspatha, Poratha, Adalia, Aridatha, Parmashatha, Arisai, Aridai, Vyasatha, the 10 sons of Haman, the sons of Hamadatha, the Jews' enemy. I didn't make it. I had to catch a quick breath in the middle. But they did not lay hands on the plunder. I practiced that, still couldn't get it all out. Sorry. But again, the Jews want to just show contempt for the sons of Haman, and so they rush through those to show that and to indicate that they all died at once. Interesting thing about the last clause in verse 10. The Jews, they did not lay their hands on the plunder. Now, if you're reading in the King James and you go to verse 15 and you go to verse 16, you will see almost the same phrase, but the word spoil is the word translated plunder here is translated spoil in the King James. It's translated prey in verse 15 and in verse 16, and the wording of the expression is modified slightly. That obscures the fact that in the Hebrew, in every single case, the wording is identical. And I think it's important. All three times, the writer has used exactly the same words to say they did not lay their hands on the plunder. They did not plunder their enemies. And why do I think that's important? The edict had explicitly said they could. So there would have been nothing illegal, nothing immoral, nothing inappropriate about their taking the plunder of their enemies. Why didn't they? Most commentators simply assume that they didn't want anybody to be able to accuse them of acting out of the same kind of greed that Haman had been acting out of, and that they didn't want to be presumed to have made themselves wealthy at their enemy's expense. Kind of like back in Genesis when Abraham refused to take the money from the king of Sodom after rescuing them from Chedorlaomer and his marauding bands. That may be a part of it at least, but I think we shouldn't overlook the prophetic significance of what's going on here, this entire event. Centuries ago, back in 1 Samuel chapter 15, the prophet Samuel, by order of God, came to King Saul and told him to paraphrase a little, to kill, to destroy, and to annihilate the Amalekites, and to destroy everything, to take no plunder, but to burn their property and to slaughter their livestock. But Saul disobeyed. You remember the story. He kept the best stuff, he spared the king, and he spared some others. And I think what the Jews understood is they saw Mordecai as the heir of King Saul finally carrying out what God said they were supposed to do against the Amalekites. And so when we're going to destroy our enemies, even if it's not just the Amalekites, we're not taking any of their stuff, we're going to destroy it. We don't want it. Or we're going to leave it and let the king have it, but we're not going to take it. And so they refused to lay their hands on the plunder. And so he says it three times in exactly the same words, that they did not lay their hands on the plunder. They did not keep any of the property of the enemies that had come up against them. And probably all of that property went into the king's treasury. We'll see that that's important later because it helps magnify Mordecai in the eyes of the king, because the king is now richer than he would have been had he followed Haman's advice. As the kingdom is blessed. We'll see that in later, not in tonight's text. Well, this result was reported to the king in verses 11 and 12. Verses 11 and 12. On that day, the number of those who were killed at the citadel in Susa was reported to the king. There were 500 of them. And the king said to Queen Esther, "The Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman at the citadel in Susa. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is your petition? It shall even be granted you. And what is your further request? It shall also be done." Well, when the report came to the king about the 500 killed in the citadel, first of all, he wondered what had happened in the rest of the provinces. If 500 died right here, what's the death toll throughout the provinces? But he didn't stop there. He asked Esther, "What else can I do for you?" What more could he do for her? And again, he's identified her as Esther the Queen by title. Now, a lot of commentators read this and conclude that the king here demonstrates, and all but one of the commentaries I checked made some comment or other about this, that he demonstrates a callous attitude toward human life, an unconcern for his subjects if he seems so careless. 500 here in the capital died. I wonder how many died outside, how many out there died. I don't think that's how we should read this. I think what we see here is the something of the king's regard for Queen Esther. His resentment at Haman's having manipulated him into potentially destroying the queen and her people. I think it also suggests his appreciation for the fact that if Haman had gotten his way, the loss of life would have been far greater. We're going to see that as we go on. Esther, though, expanded. When in answer to his question, Esther expanded her request slightly. Now, Esther looks like the bloodthirsty one. She says, "Give us another day to kill our enemies." at least here in the capital. She asked for another day to kill their enemies in Susa, in verses 13 to 15. Then said Esther, if it pleases the king, let tomorrow also be granted to the Jews who are in Susa, to do according to the edict of today. And let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. So the king commanded it should be done so. And an edict was issued in Susa, and Haman's 10 sons were hanged. The Jews who were in Susa assembled also on the 14th day of the month Adar and killed 300 men in Susa, but they did not lay their hands on the plunder. So 300 more died in the capital city. 500 in the palace citadel, 300 more in the capital on the next day. So Esther had asked for another day to kill their enemies in Susa. I mean, so far, the news of the attacks in Susa, just about the citadel, just about the palace. What she wants is a chance to address their enemies still in the city at large. I don't know exactly how to understand that, other than to assume that she's presuming that the enemies of the Jews, if they were able to maintain a strong representation in the capital, that they could presumably be a problem and an ongoing threat to her security and to Mordecai's. I mean, we've already seen that the king was vulnerable to assassination plots. It would be foolish to assume that the grand vizier and the queen would be somehow not vulnerable to such a plot. And so she's asked the king for an additional day to purge the city of those who would come up against them. And so she also asked that Haman's sons be impaled. And again, that word hang doesn't mean by a rope from a gallows. It means to be impaled, as Haman had been. And that sounds like, and again, commentators frequently treat this as she was a bloodthirsty gal, was vicious, and wanted to torture them. She wasn't torturing anybody. Remember, they're already dead, right? They're already dead. What she wants to do is use them as a deterrent to show what would happen to their enemies. It's certainly a gruesome display, but not out of the ordinary, given the historical context of the Persian Empire. These are the guys who plotted against Mordecai and the queen, and were aiding their father in the plot against Mordecai and the queen. And so having their bodies hanging there, Haman's body is long gone by now. I mean, it's been about 9 months since he was hanged. Or since he was impaled. So having their bodies out there is another visual incentive for people to show respect to the new grand vizier and to the queen. But they've purged now the entire capital of their enemies. Meanwhile, the answer to the king's question, he hadn't actually phrased it as a question. I mean, it could be considered a question, but more of an exclamation. I wonder what happened in the empire. If they've killed 500 here in Susa, now 800, I wonder what's happened in the empire. It would take a little time for the numbers to come back into to get there to the capital. He couldn't just, check CNN. We're told that the Jews had killed 75,000. Of their enemies then in the empire. In verse 16, now the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces assembled to defend their lives and rid themselves of their enemies and kill 75,000 of those who hated them. But they did not lay their hands on the plunder. 75,000 of their enemies. Now there are a lot of, again, commentators who say, well, that number is way too large. It's excessively high. The Septuagint actually says 15,000, and so some of them substitute that number because they just think 75,000 is too high. The Targums, which is the Aramaic commentaries, use the number 10,107. Not sure where they get an odd number like that, but 10,107. And so most commentators consider one of those numbers more likely. I cannot agree. I'll grant you that the number 75,000 is almost certainly rounded off, but there's no reason to consider it an exaggeration. Here's why. Conservative estimates are that the number of Jews living throughout the Empire of Persia at this time, both in Jerusalem back there and plus all scattered throughout, probably somewhere between 3 and 4 million. Had Haman's decree been successful, and the Jews been annihilated throughout the kingdom, the death toll would have been substantially greater, right? 75 to 80 times as many would have died that day. For 75,000 to die, that's only 2 to 2.5% of what the king had reason to expect to die. Had Mordecai and Esther not come forward, revealed Haman's plot, and had the counter edict out there. The total loss of life of the enemy's Jews, of the Jews of the enemies, I'll get this right in a minute. The total number of the Jews' enemies who died was approximately 2% of the total number of Jews in the kingdom who would have died had they not been permitted to defend themselves. 2 to 2.5%. So those who say that's way too high a number, they're not thinking of an empire that's as large as the Persian Empire, nor of the Jewish population as large as the Jewish population, nor of the potential for the loss of life had this not been the way this thing's worked out. And so when they say, well, the king was clearly callous and didn't care, how could a king not care if 75,000 died? You'd be a lot better off if 75,000 died than if 2.5 or 3.5 or 4 million died, right? So I don't think there's any reason to think these numbers are exaggerated. Verses 17 to 19, we read of a spontaneous celebration of the exultant. Verses 17 to 19. This was done on the 13th day of the month Adar. And on the 14th day, they rested and made it a day of feasting and rejoicing. Now remember, that's in the provinces where they killed 75,000. But the Jews who were in Susa assembled on the 13th and the 14th of the same month, and they rested on the 15th day and made the 15th a day of feasting and rejoicing. Therefore, the Jews of the rural areas who live in the rural towns make the 14th day of the month Adar a holiday for rejoicing and feasting and sending portions of food to one another. So now he's explaining why they had a couple of different days, at least early on, for the celebration of the Feast of Purim. Because of the change in the way that it was, the edict was enforced in the capital. So we have, in the provinces, they celebrated on the 14th, which was the day after the conflict. In the capital, they celebrated on the 15th, which was the day after they were finished killing the 300 extra ones there in the capital city. But the point is that everywhere they feasted and rejoiced. Everywhere they feasted and rejoiced. Now, I'll save the last portion of this chapter and the very brief chapter 10 for the final message from Esther. Let's look at three or four lessons from this section of the book of Esther. First of all, once again, something we've seen repeatedly throughout this study, God directs even the scheming of the enemy. Proverbs 16:33 says, "The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord." He directs even the scheming of the enemy. That's good to remember when we're watching the political debates and the primaries in our current political environment. You listen to some of these candidates and you think, if that guy or girl gets elected, we are doomed, okay? And, you know, I don't know, maybe so, but God's in charge. And our salvation is never going to come from Washington. Our deliverance will never come from Washington. Our deliverance comes from the Lord. And so God directs even the scheming of the enemy. A second lesson that we learn from this is God's judgment may seem slow, but it is sure. And by this, I'm thinking of the prophecy in 1 Samuel. The Amalekites think they got away with something. Okay, for hundreds of years, they've been thinking, ha-ha, we survived. God said he was going to annihilate us, and it didn't work. Well, you know, it may not have happened then, but it's going to happen eventually, and here it does. God's judgment may seem slow, but it is sure. Jeremiah prophesied, "Therefore all who devour you will be devoured. All your adversaries, every one of them, will go into captivity. And those who plunder you will be for plunder, and all who prey upon you I will give for prey." There's coming a day when the Jews are going to be completely vindicated and all the enemies of the Jews will be annihilated and God will establish his kingdom here on this earth. Hadn't happened yet, but it is coming. His judgment may seem slow, but it is sure. Another one of the lessons we've repeatedly cited through this study is that God's direction may not be evident, but it is never absent. God's direction may not be evident, but it is never absent. You may not be able to see God's hand, There's no overt statement of the hand of God at work. There's no miraculous event. There's no spectacular event. All of this is through normal human events. But there can be no question that it's God who's at work. It's the invisible hand of God. R.C. Sproul has a book by that title, The Invisible Hand, about the sovereign providential control of God of all events, and how he's working all things after the counsel of his own will, how he's working all things together for the good of those who love him, who are the called according to his purpose. Now there's a negative lesson that I want to mention too. Rather than something we should learn from this, something we shouldn't take from this, but might be tempted to. We must not draw a false conclusion from what we've read here. We need to bear in mind that the church is not Israel. Esther is not a guidebook teaching Christians how to band together and kill your enemies. Okay? This is not a statement on how we're to act today, because the situation is dramatically different. This is a historic record of how God delivered his people from a specific threat at that particular time in history. Christians certainly are permitted today to participate in the defense of righteousness through law enforcement, through military action, as authorized by the state as agents of God for good, as Paul explains in Romans 13. Christians are also authorized to defend themselves from assault, to defend their property from thieves, as our own legal system permits. However, Christians are never authorized to take personal action to kill their enemies in defense of the gospel. We are not authorized to do that, and we must not draw that conclusion from this book. Here's how I stated it for the outline. God's deliverance of the church will be at the rapture. Now, let me say this in regard to this. If, you know, this has been happening in different parts of the country from time to time. We've seen it in the news. There have been times when guys with guns come into churches and start shooting. If that happens, hit the floor. Don't run. Hit the floor. And we are not in violation of any law if those who are armed among us pull out their weapons and shoot the guy who comes in. We have the right to do that. In fact, the police would consider that shooter a hero for having taken out the shooter. So we are we're to do that. But we're not to come to church with our guns to go out into the community and compel people to get saved or die. Okay? That's a Muslim approach. That is not a Christian approach. And we've got to keep in mind that distinction. The book of Esther is not saying that that's how we are supposed to behave. Not that I thought any of us were thinking that, but I thought it'd probably be good to say it for the record, okay? When God comes to deliver the church, it'll be at the rapture. And his destruction of our enemies is going to be at Armageddon. It's not going to be out in the church lawn. 1 Thessalonians 4, Revelation chapter 19, for a couple of references, okay? But glory to the Lord, he is going to deliver us one day. He's going to catch us up into the air to meet our Savior. And there will come a time of reckoning here on this earth when the enemies of the gospel will be judged and destroyed, and God will set up his kingdom forever. I don't know when it's going to happen. I hope it's soon. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your word. We